You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
The line is St. John Hunt. St. John, thanks for joining us today.
Well, David, thanks for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here with you.
Thank you, St. John. You know, I read your wonderful book about your mom called Dorothy, The Murder of E. Howard Hunt's Wife, Watergate's Darkest Secret. I want to get into that in great detail in a moment, but before we do, for the benefit of the listeners who might not be familiar with you or your family or the story of Watergate, can you give them a little bit of background about who you are and then, I guess, come up to the point where you are now?
My father and mother were both in the OSS at a very early point in the OSS's history. OSS was Office of Strategic Service, as most listeners know. That was the predecessor to the CIA. My father, leaving the Navy, joined up with the OSS. And when the OSS disbanded after World War II, he joined up right away with the fledgling Central Intelligence Agency, which was established as an intelligence gathering service. And at the time, it was with the Cold War, and they needed to have a wide spectrum intelligence gathering agency. And my mother was in OSS briefly. It was in 1944. She had been stationed in Bern, Switzerland, and her boss was Alan Dulles, who was station chief in Bern. And she worked under an operation called Operation Safe Haven. And the object of that office was to track Nazi gold across Europe, art objects, and the things that they had stolen and looted from all the countries that they had overcome. And this was a joint undertaking by the Treasury Department and the State Department, basically to block and stop the flow of Nazi assets throughout Europe, and also to make sure that the assets, all the loot and the gold, the money, would be maintained so that there could be reparation payments after World War II. The OSS took control of the Safe Haven operation to organize it and centralize the collection of the data. Within OSS, Safe Haven, under Alan Dulles, came under the control of the SI branch, was the secret intelligence branch, as well as the X2 division, which was the counterintelligence. But to jump ahead quite a few years, my father rose through the ranks of CIA, became chief of Latin American counterintelligence. He had a very prominent position in 1954 during the Guatemala coup, where the CIA had trained a ragtag bunch of Guatemalans to overthrow the elected president there. And my father was instrumental in that whole operation. It was successful. They did overthrow the president, and they installed one of their CIA puppets as a dictator who was brutal and caused the deaths of many, many, many Guatemalans. The same team that did the Guatemala operation was tasked with doing the Cuba invasion. And, of course, that was the Bay of Pigs. And as everybody knows, that was not successful for many reasons. But primarily, according to the CIA, they blamed President John F. Kennedy, and JFK blamed the CIA. Anyway, it was a crucial moment in American history, I believe, because it was at that moment when the CIA decided to wrest control of foreign policy from the president and the State Department and take it upon themselves to dictate and enforce foreign policy as they saw fit. Now, Kennedy was aware of this tug of war going on here, and he had threatened to splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the wind. And in fact, he did fire several of the CIA's top officers after the Bay of Pigs fiasco. And then, of course, in November, he was assassinated. My father stayed with the CIA for 27 years, and upon his false retirement in 1970, he joined up with the Nixon White House. Nixon was looking for an intelligence gathering group of men that he could rely on to undertake whatever operations he thought that would benefit his reelection position in the White House. And my father put together a team with many of the Cuban exiles that had worked with him and had fought in the Bay of Pigs invasion. My mother, between all that time back in Bern and all the way up to 1970, she had continued working as an as-needed contract CIA agent in that she worked in foreign embassies, either in this country or in the host country where we were assigned to live in. And she would be able to gather internal data that the CIA deemed necessary for their intelligence gathering capabilities, and she would give that data to my father. So she kept her little covert life alive and well. And 1972, Watergate erupted, and that was the arrest of my father's team, made up of those Cuban exiles I mentioned, in the Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate office complex in Washington, D.C. And five burglars were arrested, and within a couple of days, it was determined that there was a link to the White House, and they kept following the trail. Made popular by Woodward and Bernstein's book and movie after that, All the President's Men, which was really a very light gloss over the whole thing. But that really brought down my father, my family, and my mother. And it eventually led to the resignation of President Richard Nixon. There was a lot of intensity at that time. My father and my mother were called blackmailers because they were demanding money. They were demanding payments, large amounts of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars, not only to keep quiet, but to divide that money up to help support the Cuban families of the Cubans that had been arrested, and also to keep them quiet. This went fine for a while, but when Nixon got reelected, he wasn't quite so worried anymore, and the flow of money stopped. My mother especially, she had been handling the money, going and picking it up in locker rooms at Greyhound stations or at the airport in the wee hours and waiting for phone calls and phone booths to tell her where to go and pick up the money. And the money just kept getting shorter and shorter. It just wasn't working out. So she decided to take the evidence that my father had always had that he was pressuring Nixon with revealing, take that to Chicago on a flight and call a press conference within a couple of days. Well, that press conference never happened. The plane crashed, and the National Transportation Safety Board ruled after a year that it was pilot error. But there were many, many, many suspicious things about that plane crash that just did not add up. So that's basically a little kind of short take on my parents.
Much of what you said is in the book, and I would highly recommend that folks pick up the book to find out, obviously, in greater detail about how all this unfolded. Now, you were born in what year, St. John?
1954.
54. Okay. And you have a couple of siblings as well?
Well, I do, but if you ask them, they would say no, that they don't know me. I lost that relationship with my stepmom and my two sisters over my revealing what my father had left me, the information he told me before he passed away about his knowledge, prior knowledge, and involvement in the assassination of President Kennedy.
Why don't we just briefly go into that if we could?
Yeah, I'd not really understood what my father had done. I didn't know until I was 16 that he was in CIA. They kind of sat me down and told me. I guess it was supposed to explain why we moved around so much. But the name CIA, it didn't register on any level with me. My father said it was kind of like the FBI, but taking place in foreign countries. And I appreciated their honesty. I think it was probably the only time they'd been honest with me forever. There was always some cover story about why we were in a country and what we were doing there. And of course, being a child and you grow up in that kind of atmosphere, you don't question anything because you have nothing to judge it against. I didn't know any other children, didn't know their families, so I had no comparison. So my life, I thought, was absolutely normal. I didn't realize that other children and their families didn't move every 2 years to a foreign country. Right. I thought that's what everybody did.
Right.
Starting around 1972, when my father's name was well known as being a Watergate burglar, as well as his involvement in the CIA, there started to be a little buzz going on that Dick Gregory, he's a black comedian, and then he became a sort of civil rights activist. He knew Martin Luther King Jr. and all that. I saw a poster on a telephone pole near where I was living in California saying that there was going to be a lecture at San Francisco State University with Dick Gregory talking about the three tramps and how their involvement was thought to be part of the Kennedy assassination. And on that poster was two pictures of an old sort of disheveled tramp-looking guy. And then right in the middle, there was a picture of my father. And I'm like, what in the hell is this? This is crazy. I mean, I had never heard anything about the Kennedy assassination before, never read anything. And I just thought this was just crazy. But I had to admit that certainly, in fact, that my father's photograph looked a lot like that old tramp that they were depicting on the poster. And that just started sort of a back of my head kind of curiosity. And then a few years later, there was a newspaper article published on the East Coast, a small local paper. Apparently, they got hold of a classified document from Dick Helms, who was the CIA chief in the earliest part of the 60s, saying that someday they were going to have to explain E. Howard Hunt being in Dallas on November 22nd. Well, my father sued because the implication was that he had been part of the assassination of President Kennedy. And so he sued. It went to court. Liberty Lobby was the paper that my father sued, and he won the first round. But then they appealed, and they hired attorney Mark Lane, who had written a fabulous investigation of the Kennedy assassination called Rush to Judgment. One of the earliest ones, I think, came out in 1965 or 66, I believe. And he put his case together and he had my father on the witness stand. Of course, my father, his alibi for that day was very suspicious. It changed several times. First, he said that he was at CIA in Langley, Virginia, working all day. But then they subpoenaed the records and found out that he wasn't there all day. So then he said, oh, well, he had left early and stopped by a Chinese grocery store to pick up some Chinese vegetables so we could cook Chinese food later that night. Well, that didn't turn out to work because there was no such grocery store. And from my point of view, my father never cooked Chinese food. My mother was always the Chinese chef in the house. So that was highly unlikely. Around that time, I got a letter from my dad saying to me that if asked by any law enforcement persons where he was that day, he was reminding me that he was with us children at the house that day. And of course, that kind of struck me as odd because I was let off from school early that day, came home, and my father was not at home, was not home all that day. And that also seemed odd to me. So I started thinking that, well, could my father have been involved in the JFK assassination? It's just too outrageous. But Mark Lane won the case for Liberty Lobby, and in the end, my father could not prove that he wasn't in Dallas. His witnesses didn't really recall seeing him. Everything kind of just fell apart, and he lost and had to repay a tremendous amount of money for the whole thing. As far as the tramp photos go, it was thought for years that he was one of the tramps. He always denied it. He denied it to me. And in retrospect, I have to say that although he did look like the old tramp, he was too high of a CIA officer to be monkeying around in an old tramp disguise back behind the grassy knoll where the railroad cars were. That's where the three tramps were arrested. There's always been mystery about these three tramps because they were arrested, they were brought to the police station, and then they were let go without filing any reports or anything. Years and years later, some researchers did in fact find the arrest reports, but even that's not completely clear because there's been a total, I think, of six persons that have come out and said that they were one of the three tramps. So we have twice as many people vying for that position as is necessary. So I don't know if the tramp question will ever get resolved. But later on, in 2003, my father was very ill. He had been in the hospital a dozen times with pneumonia. He had amputations on his leg. He had lupus. He had some cancer removed. And he asked me to come down to Miami to spend some time with him, which I did. And at that time, I pitched the idea to him that before he passed away, he should write another autobiography because his previous autobiography called Undercover came out in 1974 or 5, I think. And it was determined by the publishers that there were too many inconsistencies and falsehoods in that autobiography. So they pulled it from the shelves. And I said, this time, Papa, you're pretty much the last man standing here. But this can only work if you write a complete truthful account of the things that went on in your life relating to the CIA, the OSS, and the Kennedy assassination. And he agreed. And so we started this project of talking about his life and getting it down on video. I went back to California, and about 6 or 8 months later, I got a package in the mail from him. It was just a cassette, and it was marked for my eyes only. And I put it in my cassette deck, and I heard his voice came up, and he proceeded to give me a basic layout of what he knew about the conspiracy to assassinate President John F. Kennedy. I was stunned. He went as far as saying that he was a bench warmer in it. He laid the blame at the doorstep of Lyndon Baines Johnson, who he said was a complete psychopathic type person that would stop at nothing to become the president. Johnson hated the Kennedys. The Kennedys hated him. And in fact, it's well known now that had Kennedy been reelected and stayed alive, that they would have kicked Johnson off of the ticket because he was about to be indicted by the Justice Department, which his brother Robert Kennedy was head of, for crimes that he had committed all through his career, starting way back when he ran for the Senate and things like that. So I came back down to Miami to push the project with my father to the next level. And his second wife, a very nice woman named Laura, when she found out what we were planning to do, and she told his lawyer, a guy named Bill Snyder, and they just came down like a ton of bricks on my father and me. They said, you can't do this. You can't talk about this. Your father can still and will most definitely be arrested. He'll spend the rest of his life, however short it is, in a federal prison. It's going to ruin your family. He goes, aren't you tired of the ruination that has come about because of your father's different involvements and things? It ruined the first Hunt family. Your mother died over it. And now you want to bring this on this innocent second family. And I said, well, I'm not trying to ruin anything, but I think it's important. This is what Papa wants to do. Not only is it historically significant, but it's what he wants to do. He never felt shame about it. He didn't feel guilty because of it. He really felt in his heart that JFK was a national security threat, as did many of the people around JFK, the Joint Chiefs, the military people, all the bigwigs in the military-industrial complex. They felt that President Kennedy was just a national security threat. And rather than wait for him to be reelected and then possibly try to impeach him on grounds of being weak to the communism threat or being a national security threat to this country, I guess they decided to kill him. And as far as my father went with it, he said he was a bench warmer. He described several meetings that he had in South Florida in the Miami area with some persons that were Cubans, as well as another CIA officer, two other CIA officers, where they asked him to come into the plot to kill JFK. He also told me that there was more than one team that had been assembled. And he said when he found out that William Harvey, who was a CIA officer at the same kind of level as my father was involved in this, he said he didn't want to have anything to do with it, because in his opinion, William Harvey was an alcoholic psycho, nothing but trouble. He said, if Bill's involved, I'm out. But at some point, he must have felt that he had some responsibility to his Cuban exile family for the Bay of Pigs fiasco and decided to at least take some position in Dallas. And I believe that there's one photograph that shows the street in Dallas across from the grassy knoll where a large group of people are crossing the street. And there's one gentleman with a fedora hat just like my father's, with a trench coat just like my father's, same angular face, walking by himself across the street. And I think that's a picture of my father. No one has come forward and said, no, that's so-and-so or that's somebody else. The picture is too blurry to really do a facial match, but for all intent and purposes, it's the position my father would have had more likely than one of the three tramps. When he said bench warmer, I believe that was a carefully picked word, because a bench warmer is someone that's part of a team. They're at the game. In other words, that's my father telling me that, no, he's not in D.C. or he's elsewhere. No, that's him telling me that he's in Dallas. He's a bench warmer, and that means he's part of the team. He's at the game. And I believe his position in the assassination was one of authority in terms of if something had gone wrong, if the team needed help. This is the shooting team. If they needed to change plans, if they needed to extricate themselves, he would be the one to give that kind of information with authority, knowing the safe houses that they had picked out, knowing the method of transportation, the hiding places, where to get rid of the weapons, all that kind of stuff. My dad was a big planner. And I believe, and this is just my opinion about his position in Dallas, but I believe that that's more than likely his position in the Kennedy assassination. Now, as I said before, we never got to the end of it because there's so much pressure from my father's other two children, his wife, and the attorneys that he just folded. He sent me a letter, said he can't, you know, I'm not there to support him all the time. If I had been there, I perhaps would have been able to battle it with them on his behalf. But I was back in California and he was tired and he folded under all the pressure. And I didn't blame him. I don't blame him. I didn't want to see the other two kids' life tainted by his startling information to come out. I knew that at one point he felt strongly about bringing it out, but I could understand his position, and I had to respect that. He told me, though, that the information that he had given me, which was 5 or 6 pages of handwritten notes showing the chain of command all the way up to LBJ that he knew, showing me the different people involved and what their positions were, telling me about the safe house, who's at the meetings, and so forth. He said to do what I could to come out with it. And I took it as his final wish for me. Being his firstborn son, I was not about to argue that point or dismiss it. And so I waited until he passed away. And then I spent time trying to figure out how I can get this out to the public. And it was through Rolling Stone magazine. There was a gentleman that worked as a writer for Rolling Stone that I went to boarding school with in 8th and 9th grades. And finally got the message to him. He came out to interview me in Northern California. And so the article was published. And from there on, it's been something that I have tried hard not to let it monopolize my life. I'm not a conspiracy expert or a conspiracy researcher. I'm not a JFK assassination obsessive type person. And I only can speak of what I know firsthand from what my father told me. Now, I can give my opinion on certain things, but I will always state that it's my opinion that this is something that my father didn't tell me, but I feel this was something that he was alluding to or something in that nature. So that's how the deathbed confession came out. And I wrote a book about how that whole thing came out called Bond of Secrecy, which details all the information. It has copies of the handwritten notes my father left with me. The mainstream media never picked up on it. I think their tactic in such cases is not to comment on an accusation or a story like that. The best way they deal with it is just to ignore it. They don't even comment.
They quarantine it.
Yeah, and so it gets no play. Nobody's saying, no, that's not true, and there's no argument being built, no round of back and forth discussions or debates. It just goes out to the air, and then it just disappears.
Yeah, I think that a lot more people now, St. John, are aware about the incestuous relationship that the mainstream media has with government. Since the Trump election has taken place, I think that a lot more people have woken up to this mainstream media. Do you agree?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I have no way of judging that, but I know that in 1965, 5, my father was charged with recruiting journalists, magazine, newspaper editors, publishing houses, reporters, investigative journalists to work for the CIA. This was the beginning of, it wasn't Operation Paperclip.
Mockingbird.
Mockingbird, yeah. And the idea was if we had someone or someones at all the major newspapers across the country and around the world, all the major magazines, Time, Life, Newsweek, National Review, Women's Day, I suppose, you know, if we had our CIA contract agents getting paid, then we could control public opinion. They were worried about the opinion of the public if information started being disclosed. For example, the Church Committee in the 70s and the Rockefeller Commission both investigated the CIA's activities in this country and abroad and found out a whole lot of dirty stuff. And it just morphed into this international cartel of CIA paid for and sponsored publications. And now I think everybody is on that payroll, it seems to me, except for folks like yourself and Alex Jones and all the little bloggers and all those people that have their own little podcasts and stuff. My hat's off to you guys because you're keeping the true spirit of what a democracy is meant to be alive.
Well, I appreciate that. I think a lot of people would probably take issue with Alex Jones being included in that category.
Yeah, I've heard some stuff about that. They think he's part of that.
Because he doesn't really touch on the real important topics. And maybe there's a reason. I don't know. I really don't pay attention to the guy. I see he carries around a bullhorn and he's kind of full of himself. So I don't really waste any time on people like that. But your dad is basically a legend in American history. Your mom, of course, is nowhere near as well known. And your dad, in your book that you mentioned, Bond of Secrecy, on page 120, there's a bunch of photographs of your dad. And you really have a striking resemblance to him. You have in here novelist, the real-life American James Bond, model for Mission Impossible hero Ethan Hunt, CIA Black Ops and Psy Warfare, overthrew Guatemala, secret war in Cuba, assassination attempts against Fidel Castro, Bay of Pigs leader codenamed Eduardo, assassination mastermind, Kennedy hater, team leader in Dallas, secret covert action team for Nixon, Watergate conspirator, and my father. Now, your dad obviously is one of the guys behind the scenes who made things happen. And then when it came out that, oh boy, we got caught, then let's cut your dad's throat. I mean, that's basically sums it up. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. And that was a bitter pill for my father to swallow. Nixon had promised him clemency, promised him after being reelected a presidential pardon, and this was all ongoing during 1972, just prior to the last straw, my mother's death. And for years afterwards, I think until he died in 2007, I think my father just felt extremely bitter over his years of service to this country through the CIA. And he was on a destroyer in World War II before that, so he really spent his life doing what he felt was in his heart for the betterment of this country. But those were different times, and the standards of those times certainly don't equal to the standards of these days. Everybody now, if you get caught, you rat on your friends, or you immediately have a backup plan. My father had no backup plan. He just assumed that if anything went wrong, that the CIA or the White House would step in and take care of it. This was a national security operation at the DNC. In my father's mind, this was what was going on. There was some urgency to this, to break in and plant bugs and to go through the files and things like that. He'd already done a bunch of other stuff for Nixon from the moment he got there. As a matter of fact, very few people know that my father met Richard Nixon in 1957 when my father was CIA station chief in Montevideo, Uruguay. Vice President Richard Nixon came down on a goodwill tour to Latin America, and my father met him at an official function, and then they had lunch the next day together. They spent about an hour and a half talking. So even before my father was hired on in the White House, Nixon can be heard on the Watergate tapes talking about firebombing the Brookings Institute. One of the first things that Nixon wanted done. I'm not exactly sure what was the point of that, but Brookings Institute was a think tank that thought what would be the outcome this way or that way, foreign policy or domestic policy and so forth. But when he's talking to his top inner circle, Haldeman and Ehrlichman and Chuck Colson and those guys, he was talking about we need to firebomb the Brookings Institute and we should get Howard Hunt to do that job. Chuck Colson had heard of Howard Hunt because they were both Brown alumni. And the other interesting thing is that people believe that Colson went about searching for Howard Hunt and convincing him to come aboard to the White House. But in fact, the truth of the matter was is that they knew that Nixon was looking for an internal investigative team. And my father played his cards right, and he let Colson believe that Colson was shopping my father, when the truth of the matter was my father had shopped Colson to gain entrance into the White House. Now, also, his retirement in 1970 from the CIA was false. He had retired previously on another false retirement in 1965 or 66 when he went deep cover when we moved to Spain. I find this out years later. Like, I think we're going to Spain. I don't know why we're going to Spain, but I guess we're moving out and we're going to Spain, everybody. So let's go to Spain. Well, we went to Spain because my father was meeting with international assassins in Spain, continuing the Operation Type 40 assassination against Castro. This was a couple of years after the CIA had assured the White House that they had ended that once and for all. But as we know now, through declassified documents, that the assassination attempts against Castro, sponsored by the CIA, went on through the 70s even. They just didn't want to quit. I can't believe that they never were able to get that guy. It just seems either he had incredible luck or they had really a bunch of lame operatives.
Keystone cops.
Yeah. My father had also met with Johnny Rosselli a couple of times. He was the Chicago number two guy in the American Cosa Nostra to try to arrange with Rosselli's boss, Sam Giancana, the possibility of bringing the mafia in to assassinate Fidel Castro. People think that the mob had a lot to do with it, but in fact, what the CIA was doing was setting up the mafia to take the fall if it were to ever come out that John F. Kennedy had been killed as a result of a conspiracy. They now had the mob as active members of some sort of team or some sort of effort to get rid of Castro on behalf of the CIA. Something that would have never happened, never been allowed to happen, because number one, then you're indebted to the mob and that makes you weak and vulnerable. If the mob guys want to reveal something, they can put you in a bad spot. The second reason is that the mob guys can be tied back directly to the CIA because they had been working with the CIA in a number of different areas as far back as World War II, which is why William Harvey, who I mentioned before, my father was saying that if Bill Harvey was involved in the conspiracy to kill Kennedy, that he didn't want any part of it. Bill Harvey was a high CIA official. He was the number one guy in the tunnel under the Berlin Wall. He and Bobby Kennedy were at each other's throats. They hated each other because when it was found out that the CIA was continuing its guerrilla warfare attacks against Cuba and Castro, run by Bill Harvey, they demoted Bill and sent him to be station chief or substation chief in Rome. They wanted to get him out of the country. But even when he was far away in Rome, he continued to have his operatives in South Florida run operations against Castro. They would blow up radio towers. They would poison crop fields. They would blow up dams and so forth. And this went on for a long time. But when Bill Harvey was in Rome, just prior to the Kennedy assassination, he recruited and started an off-the-shelf program that he called Executive Action. And this was a program made up of non-American mafia assassins, but French Corsican underworld assassins to be used for whatever he or the CIA wanted. And it's through this connection that we gain the admittance of Lucien Sarté, who is often thought to be one of the gunmen at Dallas that day. He was a French Corsican underworld assassin brought in by Bill Harvey. So Bill was still active in all that, despite what promises were made to the Kennedy administration. There is one thing I would like to read. In the early part of November this year, I wrote an apology to Caroline Kennedy. It's been eating at me for a number of years, and I felt that someone should apologize. So I composed this letter, and I sent it to her at the embassy in Japan where she works. It's an open letter to Caroline Kennedy. It goes, "It is with the deepest respect and honesty that I reach out to you. I feel a great deal of sorrow for actions involving my father, which may have led to the death of your father. In 1963, my father, E. Howard Hunt, as a CIA officer, had knowledge of plans to eliminate your father, President John F. Kennedy. I know this because my father confessed this to me shortly before he died. It is a burden I will always carry. I cannot imagine the loss you experienced at such a young age. In the ensuing years, you have carried yourself with great dignity and reserve in the face of ongoing public speculation about your father's death. No one has ever, to my knowledge, offered any kind of apology for this horrible and unforgivable crime. It seems an insignificant gesture to apologize, but that's all I'm able to do. So for what it's worth, I am deeply regretful for my father's role, whatever it may have been, in the death of your father. I'm so sorry that history has been cruel to your family in ways most of us won't even understand. From the bottom of my heart, I offer this sincere apology and hope that you find it comforting that someone cares enough about you and what you lost to come forward and say, I'm sorry. Sincerely, St. John Hunt."
That was very beautiful. How was your dad as a dad?
Well, when he was home, I have some great memories of him. He was very supportive of my music. We would play music together. When I was 16, he used to take me down to Georgetown to the blues clubs, and they would let me in, even though I should have been 21, and I would sit in on some great jazz and blues performances. He was quite a bon vivant with the music and the jazz scene in Georgetown. He was a very funny guy sometimes. His laugh was loud and unbridled, and I remember riding on his back as a toddler, him on all fours, and then sometimes he'd put his hands above his head and bend his little fingers and saying, "I'm coming for you," and I would just be laughing and giggling, horrified, running away, and he would chase me on all fours down the hallway or something. When those things happen, they make up for a lot of time that he wasn't there. And then at the same time, he could be very cruel, very cruel. I knew that I never lived up to, even close to, anything that he was proud of. I had dyslexia. I had double vision. I stuttered to the point where I could barely speak. I was weak. I wasn't bodybuilding. I wasn't into sports. I was just this weird kid that was like a failure in my father's eyes. And that was why when he came down that night in June of 72, when his team had been arrested at Watergate and he needed my help, I would have done anything for that guy. I would have pulled the trigger and killed somebody if that's what he said he needed done. This was my moment. This was my moment to shine in his eyes. And I went for it. What am I to do? Anyways, what was I supposed to do? He needed help. One of our last conversations in Miami, we'd never talked about Mama's death, and I knew that he would just say that it was just an accident. I couldn't bring myself to try to pick his brain about it. But in these last few moments we were together, he gripped my hand so tightly and he was crying. And he was a shriveled up old little guy in this bed, and he was clutching onto me with a ferocity in his hand, and tears were coming out of his eyes. And he said, "You know, after they killed your mother, I thought that you children could be next and I wasn't able to protect you." That made the hair stand on my, it's making the hair stand on my arms and my body right now. But that was his way of telling me that he had always felt that they had killed her to keep him in line.
Your dad obviously is, or should be, well known to students of American history. Your mom, however, is not. She was behind the scenes, but she was a threat. She was called in a CIA brief an amoral and dangerous woman. Is that right?
That's correct. That was in a CIA file.
What do you think about those words that they used for your mom?
At first, I felt like this is a horrible thing to say about somebody. But in thinking about it, I thought that, you know what? She is a dangerous woman. She could be a dangerous woman. And as far as being amoral, meaning having no moral navigation, I think that's what you have to be to fight the people that are also amoral, such as the CIA, such as the White House, such as the NSA. People like that, they have no moral qualms. They don't care about collateral damage. That's why when they wanted to take her out, in my opinion, they didn't hesitate to bring that plane down. Also, they were running out of time. All our phones had been bugged for a couple of months by that point, and we were being followed everywhere. They knew she was fed up and that she had called the White House and made a direct threat to Charles Colson, saying that she was going to blow the White House out of the water. And my father backed that threat up in his last phone call to Colson because the money wasn't coming through, and my father felt that he was going to be left to face a potentially 30-year prison sentence for what he did for the White House under President Nixon. And my mother was just sick of it. She was tired of it. She's tired of going in the middle of the night to pick up money, tired of flying around and distributing the money, tired of the whole damn thing, the whole game. And she said, it just has to stop. And the only way to stop it is to call a press conference. Now, coincidentally, I don't know if this was pre-planned or not, but she was on that flight with a very prominent newswoman. As a matter of fact, the first female news persona that they had. This was Michelle Clark. She was a major CBS news persona, and she had her own place at CBS, and she was very well respected. She was on that flight with my mother. Apparently, they were sitting in the same row. I know that she had already made inquiries into Watergate, and she may have been willing to go to Chicago to do the press conference that was going to take place because she was going to blow the White House out of the water and everybody was going to go down, including President Nixon. So they had run out of time, basically. They knew she was flying to Chicago. They knew the plane was landing where and when, and there were just too many suspicious things about that plane. I can go into those now if you want.
I would want the reader to go into that because that's something that is at the end of the book. And I know when I read it, I was really shocked about all of the inconsistencies that were uncovered. But this, I think, is something really eye-opening. And when folks do get the book, Dorothy, they'll find out why that is. Has that ever been explored beyond your work and Sherman's work?
No, not that I know of. Of course, you're talking about Sherman Skolnick, who was a Chicago investigator. He actually had a pretty good track record. He investigated some judges who were guilty of corruption and things like that and got them kicked out. And when that plane crashed, he started investigating that. He actually stole the National Transportation Safety Board documents and then challenged them to reopen the case, which they did, in fact. And he really dug into that deeply. And I will forever be in debt to Sherman Skolnick for that. But besides him and myself, I don't think anybody's ever gotten into it. And I don't have the resources I don't know how to do the Freedom of Information Act. I'm not a lawyer. I also don't want to completely overwhelm my life. So in my book, Dorothy, I don't come to a conclusion as to who ordered her death because I don't have that information. But I certainly have enough information to show that it goes way beyond a normal plane crash with normal activities happening after the crash that any other crash would be subjected to. But this crash had FBI all over it, CIA all over it, White House all over it. It just was sickening.
Yes, and that's what I was alluding to, that when the readers do find out about this, they're going to be shocked that this happened the way that it did. And again, I had offered my condolences before, and I'll say it again to you, my friend.
Thank you, Dave.
St. John Hunt, the author of Dorothy, The Murder of E. Howard Hunt's Wife, Watergate's Darkest Secret. St. John, I want to thank you so much for the time you've spent explaining all this to the listeners, and I'm looking forward to talking to you again real soon.
Thank you, Dave. Thank you very much.